So Sadaketu yesterday, rather brilliantly I thought, with a lot of passion and a lot of zeal, introduced the Buddha to us. But actually who he introduced was not quite yet the Buddha. So he introduced to us the young prince, Siddhartha Gautama. And I'm going to be picking up his story today and talking a little bit about his journey as he moved closer to enlightenment, moved closer to becoming the Buddha. And where we left Siddhartha yesterday was he'd had this extremely significant experience, a series of very, very significant experiences. So he'd had what they call the four sights. So you might remember that he'd seen an old person, a sick person, a dead person, and then he'd seen this wandering holy man. He'd seen this being that was in the world with a shaved head, living very, very simply, and that was the fourth sight. And what I want to say, with the light shining in my eyes, is that I confess everything, please. I'll tell you anything. Now, what I want to say is I want to talk about, well, what is it that he actually saw? So we know on a surface level what he saw, but what was the nature of that seeing? How did he see? What was the nature of that? Because it's clear that that experience changed him in some way. It shook him to his core, and it made him reassess and reevaluate everything in his life. He'd been brought up in such a way that he had a very clear path before him. His father had very clear expectations of him, and he was set to be a great leader, a great warrior, in fact. But it made him reassess the path that had been laid out for him. So he discovered this by making these significant journeys. And I want to tell you about a journey that I made a few days ago. I hadn't planned to talk about this, but it's basically what's in the forefront of my mind at the moment, and it feels disingenuous not to talk about it. So I made my own very significant journey at the end of last week. So as most of you know, we arrived, the team arrived to the retreat center a couple of days before all of you did. And we were having, we planned to have this team retreat where everyone could be together, create a retreat atmosphere which you all would then step into. I didn't participate in the team retreat because I got here, and a couple of days before I got here, my grandmother was taken into hospital, we thought it would be fairly routine, and we thought she'd be out in a couple of days. And when I arrived here, I was expecting her to be discharged that day. But my grandmother is 100 years old, and when you're that age, anything can happen. So I got a call from my sister on the day that we arrived to say that she'd had a major stroke. That she wasn't going to survive, basically, that she was dying. So I made the decision that I was going to leave the team retreat and make a journey up to Newcastle, which is where my grandmother lives and where I hail from. She actually lives in Gateshead. She lives in a place called Hebburn, which was very difficult for me when I was a child, because people would say, you know, I'd say I went to visit my grandmother, and they'd say, oh, where does she live? And I'd say, Hebburn. And they'd go, oh, Hebburn, that's so sweet. I'd be like, no, Hebburn. Trust me, it's really not like heaven in Hebburn. But anyway, she lives, although she won't be going back there. I made this journey up to see her, and it's just been incredibly significant for me. So I went to see her in the hospital, and she's tiny, my grandmother. She's absolutely tiny. I can tell you exactly how tall she is, actually, because she's this tall. And I know this because like when I say when I was say, would say goodbye to her or hello to her, I'd get down here and she'd be at eye level, so I'd give her a kiss or a hug or something. She's this tall, and when I got there, you know, she's in the bed. She's this tiny looking woman, and she's dying basically. She's taking her last breaths. She is actually still alive, but she won't be with us for much longer. Maybe another day or two. So Sadaketu mentioned this last night. You know, he talked about this sight of seeing a dead body, or even seeing a dying body. And I don't know if people have seen anyone who's dying here, but it's quite interesting because the body changes shape. It starts to change form. So she'd started to change form, but it was almost like her face was just sort of reaching out a little bit. Her body had changed, and it was like she was reaching out. And when I arrived, she just managed to slightly open her eyes. She's got these beautiful blue eyes, and when I arrived, she just slightly opened them, and I was able to communicate with her a little bit. And I stayed with her for the next couple of days, and then I made the decision to come back. She's still alive, but she won't be alive for much longer. But the reason why I wanted to talk about this is because basically this is what I'm talking about, and this is what Sadaketu is talking about when he talks about the four sights. So it's not just seeing something. It's seeing something, experiencing something, being in the presence of something where the experience changes you. And you're not quite the same afterwards. Your heart opens, it reorientates your being. And this experience really changed me, of being with her, because what I felt was, and I have experienced this before, but not in such an intense way, is it just put everything in perspective. Like, you realize what is important and what isn't important. And I had this deep-seated feeling that really the only thing that is important in life is love and connection. It's love and connection. It's us connecting with each other. It's us learning how to open our hearts so that we can love ourselves and we can love other beings, and the way that will change the world. I had a very, very deep sense of that, and I'm extremely grateful to my grandmother for that, because in a sense that's the final gift that she's given me, really. She's given me many, many gifts in my life. When I was a child, she used to give me 60p pocket money a week. And I used to go to, I lived in Whitley Bay. I don't know if anyone knows Whitley Bay, but there was an amusement arcade there called the Spanish City, and you could get 3 games of pool for 20p. So that's what I used to spend her pocket money on. But she gave me many other gifts. She lived with us when I was a child, and she raised me, and she helped me to, basically helped to make me the man that I am today. So I'm very, very grateful to her. So these opportunities are really, really precious. These opportunities that open our heart, that almost give us a new way of seeing or being, they are extremely precious, because it's almost like they're a portal into another world. It's like something else opens up, because we're so much on the surface of our lives so much of the time. We're so much stuck in triviality and things that aren't important. And what these experiences do is they open up this little portal, but the portal doesn't stay open. It doesn't stay open on its own. It only stays open if we act on it. So that experience is only valuable, A, if we're open to it, and B, if we're receptive to it, and B, if we somehow change our lives on the basis of that seeing or that experience. It needs to be acted on. So Sangharakshita, who's the founder of our movement, founder of our order, who lives very close to here, he talks about the Buddhist path being a path of vision and transformation. Vision and transformation. And I think what we have in the four sights is the vision, and what I'm going to talk about a little bit is the transformation. So the transformation is the action that you take on the basis of that seeing. And when we do that, something starts to happen. It starts to change us. It starts to create a new being. And I was thinking about this, and I was trying to think of vision experiences from my own life. And I thought about really what an experience that set me on the path when I was a teenager. So a vision experience that set me on my own path, which has been a long path and not a straight one by any means. But when I was 14, can you picture a kind of a, I don't know, young, innocent-looking 14-year-old version of me sitting in a craft design and technology lesson when I was 14. I can remember what I was doing at the time. I was redesigning an album cover for a band called Stump. And I'm imagining that nobody in this room has heard of Stump. They certainly didn't trouble the charts. They might have made John Peel's Festive 50 at some point, but their biggest hit was a song called Charlton Heston, which has a chorus that goes, Charlton Heston put his vest on. Anyway, so I was sitting in this lesson, and suddenly I just had this incredible feeling where I looked out of the window and I was just looking at the school playing fields, and I must have seen that same sight 100 times, 200 times, but I felt different. Something had it was almost like something had sort of taken me over or invaded my consciousness, and my experience was just one of beauty. I was suddenly, everything looked really, really beautiful. I didn't look down at the Stump album cover, but I did just look out at the fields and just think, I couldn't even conceptualize it. The only thing I could do was say thank you. So that's what I did. I didn't know what was responsible for this experience, but I said thank you. I just felt gratitude. It was like, goodness me. And these experiences actually continued throughout my teens. I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again, because a lot of you weren't here when I gave a talk here about 4 years ago, and I was saying, so these experiences continued, and I didn't know what they were. I just assumed that everybody had these experiences, these feelings of sort of bliss. And it was kind of like, it felt to me like it was a bit like an orgasm, but one which happened in your head, or it seemed to originate from your head. And, you know, so I called them mental orgasms. And I remember being at a party, and I said to this girl, who's a bit older than me, you know what's coming, don't you? I said, don't you ever have these like mental orgasms? And she said, James, which was my name at the time, she said, James, I've never had any kind of orgasm. And it's not for want of trying. But I didn't know, you know, I just assumed that this, you know, this happened to everybody. But so in a sense, that what that told me was there's something more to life. There's something more to life. It seemed like there was a magic and a beauty to life, which I hadn't experienced before. It's almost like somebody pulled back this veil and there was something else there. I didn't know what to do with it. You know, I didn't know what to do with this experience. I mean, I felt basically like I'd been touched by the hand of God, you know. And I grew up in a very rough town in the north of England, and people don't get touched by the hand of God there. Like, I was thinking, like, where in the town where I come from, Berwick-upon-Tweed, it's on the Scottish borders, just on the English side of the Scottish border. There, they call young men there chavers, and the local paper is called the Berwick Advertiser. And I was thinking, I could see the headline in the Berwick Advertiser, you know, 15-year-old chaver touched by the hand of God. it's not going to work. So I didn't know what to do with it, and I did the only thing I could think of, because I tried to speak to my RE teacher about it. He didn't know what to say to me. My parents were agnostics. They didn't know what to say to me. So I basically went to a church group, and I tried being a Christian for a while. That didn't really work out, but the thing is, like, what I'm trying to say is I took action. I did something in relation to it. I was curious, I wanted to do something. So I just looked for help in the, you know, in the only place I could find it, really, which was in the church at the time. There were no Buddhist groups, there was nothing like that anywhere, basically. So how does this relate to Siddhartha? Because I've gone all the way up to Berwick-upon-Tweed and Stump. And so what he saw was, he saw something deeply, he felt something deeply, his heart was open, it had changed him. He couldn't go on living his life in the same way. He'd seen the pain and suffering of human life in the old person, the sick person, the dead person. He'd seen that, but he'd also seen this fourth sight of the holy man. And in that, he'd seen that there might be the potential for living his life differently. So he did something about it. He knew that he couldn't carry on living his life in the same way. He had to act on the basis of that vision, and he had to set out on the path of transformation. So what he did was, he left the palace. He decided that he would leave his life and he would set out on a quest to find the truth. And I would imagine that he didn't quite know even what it was that he was looking for at that time. But he left the palace, so he summoned his charioteer again for the final time. He got his horses together, and he went in the dead of night to the edge of his kingdom. With his charioteer, he went to the edge of his kingdom. And I think that's deeply symbolic, because what it says to me is that he went to the edge of what was familiar. He went to the edge of what was comfortable. And when he got to the edge of his kingdom, he basically took off his finery, so he would have been wearing these very, very expensive clothes, probably with gold thread, wearing the clothes of a prince, basically. And he found a beggar and persuaded him to swap clothes with him. Probably didn't have to do much persuading, because this beggar was just wearing rags, basically. And the other thing he did was he shaved off his hair. And I think both of these things are deeply symbolic. So the shaving off of hair has a symbolism, and it's traditional. When one becomes a monk or a nun, one shaves off one's hair. And this is what Siddhartha did. And I think what that says to me is, like, there's no going back. So he can't just change his mind and go back to the palace in a couple of hours. You know, he's got rid of his clothes, he's shaved off his hair. And in changing his clothes, it's like changing his identity. He's swapping his identity with somebody who is an absolute nobody. So there's no going back from this. So he sets off on this path, he shaved his hair, he's wearing just rags, basically, and he proceeds into the forest. So the places where the Buddha lived, I've spent time, I mean, you can retrace the footsteps of the Buddha, but at the time when the Buddha was there, it was very, very different. So most of the area where the Buddha lived would have been covered in forest. And the forest at that time was a place really to be feared, because there would be tigers, there would be snakes. It would be a really, really terrifying place to go. So can you imagine what this was like for the Buddha? Setting out on this path, he's come from this extreme comfort. He had a palace for every season of the year, and he set out on this quest, for he doesn't quite know what yet. And there he is, doing what, responding to the call, responding to this heart opening that he's had, but in a very, very, very challenging situation. And there's a story as well about the Buddha around this time, which I think to me conveys something of his humanity at this time, which is that he was begging for food. So the holy men of their day would beg for food, and they would just be given food all in one bowl, basically. So everything, you know, your, I don't know, whatever it is that they were eating in the day. It certainly wasn't mince pies and all of that sort of thing. Whatever it was, all mixed up together in a bowl. And the Buddha was eating, And he'd been used to such fine food that he vomited. So his stomach couldn't take this food, basically, and he vomited. And this, to me, speaks deeply of his humanity and also the suffering that he was willing to endure as he set out on this quest. And I think it points to something very, very significant for me, which is that the Buddha didn't have it all worked out, or Siddhartha didn't have it all worked out. He didn't know exactly what he was doing. It's very, very tempting, isn't it? We look back with a historical perspective. For those of you that know the story, and even those of you that don't, because we know what happened, and because we see where the Buddha was when he became the Buddha, and who he became and what he became, it's very easy to think that he knew what he was doing. But that's not the case. He didn't know what he was doing. And I think why that is significant is because we can look at people, even though they're a bit closer to us, people who've been practicing Buddhism for a while, or people that are a bit further on than we are, and we can think, oh, they know what they're doing. It's all right for them. They don't have the same issues that I have. They know exactly what they're doing. Well, I'm here to tell you that I don't really know what I'm doing. My Trebandu doesn't really know what he's doing. Dani Yutar doesn't really know what she's doing. Of course that's not true. In a sense, they do know what they're doing. My Trebandu, he's very, very experienced. He's been practicing a long time. He has a lot of wisdom. But he doesn't have it all worked out. I don't have it all worked out. I experience doubt. I experience negativity. Sometimes I experience ambivalence. But what I've done is I've made a commitment, and I just keep taking the next step. And that's what Siddhartha did in his life. Was he didn't let that fear stop him from taking action. He just kept taking the next step. And that's what I've done. And in a way, that's what my Trebandu's done. And everybody who walks the Buddhist path does that. They just keep taking the next step. I remember my preceptor, so the person who ordained me, someone who I love very much, Jnanavacha, the best piece of advice he ever gave me was, just keep taking the next step. Just keep taking the next step. He probably said, keep taking the next step. Which is what he likes to say. I think I'm allowed to say that, but anyway. It's the best piece of advice. I mean, he's given me a lot of very, very good advice over the years, but that was priceless. Just keep taking the next step. So the Buddha's next step, he had to take a next step, and his next step was that he sought out teachings from teachers of the day. So he found teachers that could offer him spiritual advice, that could teach him to meditate, who could set him on the path. And he sought out two teachers, Kalama and Ramaputra. And he joined their communities, and he learned to meditate, and he mastered very, very deep states of consciousness. Very, very deep states of consciousness. And very quickly, it became obvious that he was an extremely adept and talented and able pupil. To the extent that what happened with Siddhartha was that actually they offered him, with one teacher, co-leadership, and with the other teacher afterwards, leadership of both of their communities. So he learned very, very quickly everything that he could possibly learn from these teachers. But somehow he wasn't satisfied with what he learned from them. What he found was that he was able to master these deep states. He was able to enter these spheres of consciousness that were talked about, but still his mind was the same afterwards. When he came out of meditation, he wasn't fundamentally changed. He hadn't found the answers to the questions that he was looking for, which was the question of human suffering. Why do we suffer? Why do we die? Is there anything that we can do about that? So he left and he went on from those communities. And I think, I was reflecting on this, I think for me, I think with all of this, with every stage of this story, what we've got to ask ourselves is, what does this mean for us? What's the relevance for us? What's the relevance for us in this room? What's the relevance for me, the relevance for you, the relevance for all of us? What does it mean to us? And this, to me, is very, very significant, because it shows that he wasn't prepared to just settle down. So he didn't reach these states, or even he didn't have this level of sort of renown. He's very, very well regarded by these teachers and their communities, but that wasn't enough for him. He was prepared to walk away from all of that, because it wasn't what he was looking for, so it wasn't enough for him. He didn't want to stop, he didn't want to settle down, no matter what was on offer. So what he did then was he followed what was the wisdom of the time. And in India at the time, it was believed, a very, very pervasive belief, which is still the case in India actually to this day, that you can find enlightenment, you can find the answer to these deep spiritual questions through practicing austerities. So he didn't go and find David Cameron. What he did was, it's got nothing to do with him. He basically tortured his body. So the belief was that in torturing the body, you could subdue the mind. You could bring the mind under control, and you could find the answer to these questions that Siddhartha was longing for. So people who are practicing austerities, they would lie on beds of nails. They would... I saw this article in a magazine about 10 years ago about a man who'd basically, in India, he'd had his hand up for about 15 years, like this. And basically, his arm just stayed like that. And this man was a wandering holy man in India. So things like that. What Siddhartha did was he starved himself. So he basically punished his body through not eating. So the legend has it that he lived on a grain of rice a day. And his body started to wither away very, very quickly. And he became extremely weak. And it's said that he could touch his spine through pressing his stomach here. He could touch through to his spine. He was so thin. And his eyes became sunken in his head. And his hair started to fall out. And he basically looked like a skeleton. And he was so good at practicing these austerities that he started to attract a following. So people thought, Gotama is so good at this, he must be on the cusp of finding an answer. So he had these followers that would follow him, and they thought they were really onto something. And this brought Siddhartha to the edge of death, basically. He very, very nearly starved to death. He pushed himself to the absolute limit with this. But what he found was, again, that this wasn't the answer. He wasn't finding the answer through starving himself. That's not where the answer was to be found, and that became clear to him. And he was, as I said, he was almost at the point of death. His body was so weak he could barely move. It's quite a thing to contemplate that, just how far he was prepared to push himself, but then also to be prepared to admit that that wasn't it, that he'd gone so far down this kind of blind alley, but he was prepared to come back from it. And one day he was found by a milkmaid, basically, and she thought he was a spirit. She thought he was one of these evil spirits that dwelt in the forest. So kind of fearsome looking was him, and so alarming was he, that she thought he was some sort of animal or spirit. And she made an offering, basically. She made an offering to him. She made him an offering of rice pudding, which is very nice, I think, which was traditional in the day. And he began to eat. And his strength started to come back. His strength came back to the point where he was able to bathe. He was able to bathe in a nearby river. And again, I think this is symbolic for me, this thing of bathing and cleansing. It's like he's cleansing himself of this old life, and he's moving on to something else. And I think there's also something in the fact that it was a simple act of human kindness from this milkmaid that saved his life. Without her, we wouldn't be sat here today. It was a simple act of human kindness that she gave him some food when he was half dead, basically. And having eaten and having bathed, he sat down to reflect on his experience. And he recalled an experience, which is actually, this was what put me in mind of my experience when I was a teenager. It really resonated with me. He remembered, Sadaketu mentioned this last night, he remembered an experience he had when he was a teenager of a spontaneous arising of joy and tranquility. This is what he remembered. And it wasn't just that he remembered that. Again, this had a vision-like quality to it, this experience. So something in him was changed by this memory. Something in the recollection really, really changed him. And part of that was what he realized about that memory. And what he realized was that he wasn't forcing himself into anything, and he wasn't looking for anything. He wasn't trying to force an experience. He wasn't being hard on himself. He wasn't punishing himself when this memory took place. But it was just a spontaneous arising of bliss and joy and tranquility. And he thought to himself, well, if I can get back to that experience, maybe that's the way. So starving myself wasn't the way. The way of pleasure wasn't the way. He knew that from when he was a young boy. But neither were these extreme conditions that he put himself through, and neither were trying to force these meditation experiences that he'd experienced with the teachers that he'd been with. It was something that was above all of those things, something that was different from all of those things, and he felt that because he'd experienced it before, it was within his grasp, it was obtainable to him. And what he did was, he made a resolution. He decided to sit down and to basically not move again until he'd found the answers that he was looking for. So he found a place to sit down, and actually a cutting from the tree that he sat under is still in India today. You can go to India and you can see this tree, the Bodhi tree. It's called the Bodhi tree because that's what the Bodhi means, wisdom. And it's a cutting from the original tree that the Buddha sat under. And he found a place to sit under this tree. He sat on a pile of grass, and he made this resolution that he would not move until his consciousness had changed to the point where he had the answers that he was looking for. That's the vow that he made. So it's incredibly strong. He'd been through this whole experience, and then he'd made this resolution that he wasn't going to move until he found the answers that he was looking for. So I'm going to say a bit more, but that's where we leave the Buddha for now, is having made that vow and sat down under the Bodhi tree. But I want to say a little bit more about the significance of this. So this will be obvious to you. You know, I don't need to point this out, but I'm going to say it again because I think it's worth saying. Obviously, this is a myth. You know, it's a meta story in a sense. It's a story that covers lots of stories, and hopefully it speaks to us about our story. It's not literal. Every single part of the story has its own significance, and there are many, many, many things that I haven't had time to say. But the point about it is that hopefully it says something to us about our life. It's not a literal teaching. And I was thinking about the fact that this isn't a literal teaching. And my friend Sangajit came to mind, who's a very dear friend of mine. And I was speaking to him a couple of days ago because he's a palliative care nurse. And he was very, very helpful. I was talking to him about my grandmother. So Sangajit is at home at the moment. I know that he'll be watching this talk, so I wanted to mention him. So he is he's a nurse, he has a partner, he has children. And I was thinking, like, what would it be like if he came along to the Buddhist center and we said to him, okay, you know what you need to do, yeah? You need to leave your kids, you need to leave your wife, you need to stop being a nurse, You need to go and live in Epping Forest. That's what you need to do. Yeah? You need to starve yourself to the point of near death, and then if there's a passing milkman, grab some rice pudding off him. It's not like that. Of course it's not like that. Why I'm saying all of this is you need to think about what this story says to you about your own life. What does this say to you about your own life? And one thing I was thinking about is that Siddhartha chooses to go forth. So he chooses to face head on the problem of human suffering. That's his teaching. You know, I think this is the great teaching that he gives us, is that he didn't stay in the palace. He didn't give up. He kept taking the next step. And each time he was facing head on the problem of human suffering. And that's the choice that we have. We can either face it or we cannot face it. But the thing is, what he was trying to confront, if we can move towards it voluntarily, we can go towards it, we can face it with curiosity, with interest, with love, with an open heart, we can look at the problem of human suffering, or we can turn away from it. But if we turn away from it, it doesn't go away. In fact, if we turn away from it, all it does is it terrorizes us from the darkness, from our subconscious. You know, whether that's things that we need to face within ourselves or things that we need to look at in the world, we can face them square on, or we can let them come for us. The work that I used to do before I worked for Karina was I had a really wonderful job. I was working in Tower Hamlets, and I used to run discussion groups with older people, so people in their 70s, 80s, 90s, and I used to facilitate these communication groups. And it was a real teaching, because what you'd see in those groups is basically that you become the life that you have lived. Whatever life you choose to live, that's what you become when you're old, you know. I'm not going to say much more about that, actually. I'm not going to explain it away, but you become the life that you live. And I saw it very, very clearly. And I saw it very, very clearly with my grandmother. You know, this sense that she was very much at peace, because she's basically spent her life giving love, even though she suffered a huge amount. And the problem of human suffering, or difficulty, or the challenges that we face in the world, they come to us in different guises, don't they? Sometimes it's losing our job, sometimes it's losing a partner. So what brought me back to the Buddhist path was a very, very painful relationship breakup. Or it's the death of someone. Those things will appear in our lives. But the question is whether we let those things open us, and whether we let those things deepen our experience, and whether we learn from them, or whether we turn away from them and we distract ourselves and we stay with the trivialities and the surface things of life. Because we can endlessly distract ourselves. We don't have any problems finding distractions. But sometimes that vision, it's not painful. It's beautiful, as I've described. Sometimes it's like the experience that I had with my grandmother. Sometimes it's the experience that I had when I was a teenager. And this going forth of the Buddhas, he was facing that, or the Buddha-to-be, Siddhartha, he was facing that. But in a sense, that's something we're doing all the time. So as Maitreya Bandhu said last night, the four sights, they're there all the time. Reality is constantly trying to teach us something. It's just whether we're open to that experience, whether we're open to it, and whether we're receptive to it. And it's something that we have to face continually. It's not something we do once and for all. And that's what Siddhartha did in his journey. It was something that he continued to do. And in a sense, each stage of his journey is like a different manifestation of that going forth. It's a different kind of going forth that was called for in a different situation. Sometimes he was doing it by himself, sometimes he was doing it alone. The Buddhist path is one that we do in relationship with other people. As you'll all have gathered, you know, we place a very big emphasis on on friendship and supporting each other in our movement. But ultimately, that's a commitment that we make on our own, and it's something that we need to do. We need to be prepared to do on our own, and it's a path that we tread with others, but it's our own commitment that bears fruit. So the other thing about Siddhartha's journey is that it wasn't linear. And our own journey might not be linear. It may not always be straightforward. But each step of his journey was necessary. So it's tempting to think, oh, well, he did the wrong thing, or if only he'd sat under the Bodhi tree at the start of the journey. But it doesn't work like that, does it? He had to go through each step in order to get to his final resting place as Siddhartha. Even if that meant finding out, what not to do. And I feel like that with my own journey as well, as I said, I mean, sometimes we look at people and we think they were sort of born Buddhist, or that they sort of, a friend of mine, Anthony, once was saying about this on a retreat about 10 years ago. And again, he was talking about one of our Buddhist teachers, and he said, I'm sure he wasn't born. He just sort of emerged from this jeweled egg, And we can think that, can't we? But that's not the case. It's certainly not the case for me. I was a very, very, very different person in some ways to 20 years ago to who I am today. And my path wasn't linear. And I had to seek out different things and find different ways. But at each step, I just kept taking the next step. And the thing with Siddhartha, which is what we can learn, is he didn't give up and he didn't settle. So these vision experiences are precious because they give us that golden, beautiful perspective that I was talking about. We need to listen to those experiences. We need to respect them. We need to honor them. But we need to act on them. That's the decisive thing. And I just want to close with a little story, which is that how long ago would this be now? Maybe 20 years ago, I was in India. I was living in Calcutta at the time, and I was on holiday. I was having a short holiday with a friend in the foothills of the Himalayas. And I was in a place called Dharamsala. I don't know if anyone's been to Dharamsala. It's a very, very beautiful place. And we went for a walk up this mountain. And in the mountain, we went into this cave. And in the cave was this little grotto. It was absolutely beautiful. It was like we'd stumbled upon this little kind of magical world. And in this little grotto were all these painted stones. And on one of the stones, it said this thing, which I've never, ever forgotten. It said, it's understandable when children are afraid of the dark, but the real tragedy is when grown-ups are afraid of the light. It's understandable when children are afraid of the dark, but the tragedy is when grown-ups are afraid of the light. I don't know who said that. Some people say it was Plato, some people say it wasn't Plato. I don't really care who said it, to be honest. What I do care about is that it speaks to all of us deeply, because we all have the potential to shine. We all have the potential to be that light. And I was thinking about, well, really, what does that mean? What does that light mean? And it's our potential. It's what this rupa represents. This is what this is it's a representation of our potential. Because we can become infinitely bigger and more beautiful and more compassionate, all of those qualities that we want to develop. We can become that. That's our potential. But we need to act in order to develop that potential. Our potential isn't just a given. It doesn't just grow by itself. We have to act, and we have to choose to listen to it. We can choose to ignore those precious opportunities, but we do that at our peril. And in a sense, if we do that, we betray ourselves. Or we can choose to do what Siddhartha did, which is through fear, through uncertainty, even when he was abandoned, even when he was half dead, he responded to life. He responded to that vision. He chose to tread the path of transformation. That's what Siddhartha chose to do. The question is, what do we choose to do? What will you do? Thank you.